For me personally, I have a great frustration with art. Art is incredibly conservative right now. It holds on to this idea that the artwork should be seen in a white room, in a controlled environment. I want to see art just explode out of that system. Art that you can discover, things that can change continuously, that can embrace change. With Mirage, it was really an attempt to make an installation, a sculpture that would merge with the landscape around it. And I'd look over my shoulder to see it, and I couldn't find it. Can the viewer step inside the artwork? Can they become it? Can they eat it, even for an instant? Mm.
If you could spend a moment with some remarkable people and discover what their life sounds like, what would you ask? Welcome to Are We On Air? An audio encounter. I'm Armand Afey, and each episode will feature one conversation with an inspiring friend of mine who will share with us the soundtrack to their life. Hello, beautiful people, and greetings from sunny Miami Art Basel, fresh to your ears with a very fitting episode, as this week's guest is a master of his craft, the American multidisciplinary artist that is Doug Aitken. From large-scale immersive installations to photography to movies and print, he does it all. Doug kindly invited me a good couple of months ago to his very cool studio in Venice, California, where we got a sneak peek into his creative process, unlocking the mysteries behind his groundbreaking works, which we captured all on film, which you can watch now on our YouTube channel at Are We On Air? Personally, I'm very drawn to art that plays with all your senses, that you can feel and experience and not just look at. Hence, I've been an avid fan of Doug's work for many years. And many of you might even recognize one of his most famous works, which went viral on Instagram a good couple of years ago and has been a regular in gazillions of mood boards ever since. The Mirrored Mirage, a house built out of mirrors in the middle of nowhere in the desert of Palm Springs during the outdoor exhibition that was Desert X. Doug's world is a harmonious blend of rocks, steel, and glass, orchestrated by a collective artistic village. And the sheer scale and innovation will blow your mind. We explore Doug's artistic roots and his life soundtrack. Of course, tracing back to the rhythmic tapestry of African music and linked to an obsession with record covers since his childhood. But we also reflected on California's melodic migration and covered the role that Los Angeles plays in Doug's world through images, trends, and media. Basically, all these immaterial things that shape our cultural landscape. Now, if you haven't already, then do follow us on our brand spanking new YouTube channel and dive deep into a visual and auditory feast. On that note, I gotta head back to the beach and have a pina colada while you enjoy this episode. Cheers.
That was after 5 mezcals, right? Oh my God, now I have an idea for a question. You mentioned mezcal.
And are you from London?
I'm from Cologne.
Oh.
Yeah, I'm Persian, born in Cologne. And then moved to London when I was like 17, 18 to finish school. I went to an English school in Cologne. And via Lisa Dennison's son. You remember Lisa Dennison?
Yeah.
He did an internship at the RA for a week because he was doing an exchange program. So that's why he was in London. And we have mutual friends. And that's when Norman needed an assistant for the Baselitz retrospective. And someone who speaks German, English, who's like in culture.
Sure, yeah.
And somehow they is like, oh, Armin should be doing this.
And
And we met and then, assisted him for two years on that show. Yeah, and that was great. Like, I was like 18, 19, being in Munich in the studio with Georg. And, you know, that was incredible. Yeah.
And Cologne was like such an epicenter.
It was New York Cologne in the 80s. Yeah, that was the epicenter of the art world. I mean, Art Cologne was the original art fan.
Yeah. I just was going through my studio yesterday and I was looking at old business cards. I found a card from Sigmar Polko.
Oh, wow.
You know, we just met once and it was in Zurich at this restaurant. This curator set it up. She said, I was in Barcelona and she said, you've got to come here. You've got to come here for dinner. I can't tell you why. You know, I was 25 or something. And so I take her word for it. I fly to Zurich and I get there at this time that I'm supposed to be there. But my flight is totally late. It's like 3 hours sitting on the runway, right? And finally, I race to this restaurant where I'm supposed to have a rendezvous with her. And there's three seats at the table. That's Sigmar Polka and her and myself. And the whole her whole plan was to introduce us. But because I was late, Polka was completely insulted. And he thought, who is this stupid young American artist? Like, I just hate him. So I'm sitting at this table with three people, and Sigmar Polka wouldn't talk to me. And it's like an hour, 2 hours, and it just keeps going. And he just, no eye contact, won't talk to me. Yeah, I'm sitting there eating my salad, my, you know, soup or whatever. And finally, like, I hear the music of the restaurant come on, and it's a Central African piece of music that I knew. And I just kind of said to myself something like, you know, oh, is that this group? Is that? And he looks at me and goes, you know this music? And I say, you know, yeah, of course I do, you know. And he says, I love African music. I didn't know that. And then, like, it just went all night, like, drinks, you know, everything. And by the end of the night, the busboy, the owner, the waiter, were all trying to kick us out.
Yeah.
And Polka says, oh, you don't want us in your restaurant? You want us to leave now? And then the guy said, well, I didn't say that, but, you know, you need to leave now. He said, well, I'd like to show everybody a waterfall. And these, you know, waiters and stuff say, you know, like, what is this guy talking about, this, like, large, drunk German man? So he takes all the plates on the table, the salad plates, the dessert plates, he stacks them up so it's about 3 feet high, glasses, wine glasses, bottles, and he makes this pyramid of, like, debris. And then he takes a bottle of water and he pours it over it, and it starts cascading down across the table onto the floor. There's lettuce and tomatoes dripping onto the floor. And he stands up and he says, now I show you a waterfall, and now we leave. You know?
That is amazing.
Yeah. So I just found his card yesterday, and it was so weird. I met a girl just the other day who's, I think, married to his son. It's like life is circuitous. It's these huge loops that just kind of keep speeding back on each other.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, wow. And it's funny that now that he said polka and African music, it totally makes sense looking at his art now, because it's like these, like, broad strokes and these, like, figurines, right?
Yeah. And, you know, when you think of African music, so much of it kind of goes back to the polyrhythm.
Yeah.
You know, and this idea of, like, different time codes merging, you know, creating these beautifully complex rhythms. You know, and I think in a lot of ways that is very similar to how many creative people think. It's kind of our neuro network.
You know, you're
taking diverse ideas and welding them together. You're collaging experiences and memories and into a kind of a tapestry of what you're creating.
Well, the tapestry I love to create is the soundtrack to your life.
Oh, God.
And music plays such a big role in your life.
Yeah.
And that's where this concept of this interview series came by. And why don't we start at the beginning? With what's your earliest significant musical memory that shaped you as an artist?
I think it was, you know, I was obsessed with record covers. And I'm an only child. My mother and father were, like, restless people that were always on the road traveling, you know, low budget traveling, you know, to, you know, camp in the Amazon or go to Central Africa or, you know, even like Russia during the Cold War. So I would, you know, just tag along. They would kind of just bring me along. And I was always absorbing, you know, what they were into, and books, music, things like that. So some of my youngest memories of art was actually just obsessively scrubbing through album covers and kind of memorizing these album covers, you know, the illustrators who made them, the photographers, like what they were.
Studying even the credits.
Yeah, yeah. I really love that idea of, you know, the album. The album itself, the idea of an album is... it's kind of synesthesia. You know, you have an image and then you have music that goes with that image. You know, now we just have downloads. So it's very cold and very calculating. We don't have that kind of organic relationship.
Mm. And do you remember a record that really stuck with you? I mean, you picked it up from your parents and that image immediately just drew you in. And it's like, what is this? And you put it on. And
yeah, yeah. Some people, you know, learn about popular music and rock and roll. And for me, it was like a meteorite landed on me. And, you know, I'm in this neighborhood, it's summertime, I'm out of school, I'm just riding my bike around the street aimlessly. And I ride down the street because I see all these square objects lying in the middle of the street. And I go down and I look, and there's one record after another. And I start picking them up and holding them, and there's maybe 15 records. And it was...
someone's trash.
It was just trash. Someone had thrown in the middle of the street. And I no idea why, where it came from. You know, probably some stoner in a Camaro just threw them out the window of his car. So I take the stack of records. I've never heard of any of this stuff before. Yeah. I go back, I take my, you know, children's record player and put the needle down, and it's, you know, Black Sabbath, Zeppelin IV, you know, Rolling Stones, Sticky Fingers, like all these things. And in a like very short amount of time, you know, I hear this kind of scream from my mother, you know, what is that noise? And then I know I was onto something.
My mom's rebelling.
Yeah.
How old were you?
Oh, I was just really young, like 5, 6
or
something.
Wow.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah.
So Black Sabbath?
I mean, just music in general. I think it's always been kind of interwoven through my reality. That same, you know, also as a child, another moment, I can't believe this podcast is going back to like, you know, a 5-year-old on a street.
That's what it's all about. Because you know what? I'm also a therapist in the end. I'm sure I'll find something in your work from that moment.
And your card says, I think very deeply.
Yeah.
but I tell you, like this other time, you know, same thing. I'm out on the street. My father says, you know, Douglas, you got to come down here for lunch. You know, tell me if an old car pulls up outside. Old car pulls up. I come down to have lunch with them. And he says, we're not having lunch here. We're having lunch next door with our neighbors. And he takes me by the hand, walk next door. We sit down. There's this old man at the end of the table. Our neighbors are the percussionist and violinist of the Philharmonic.
Oh, wow.
And my father and I, this little tyke. And that was Igor Stravinsky. And, you know, we're having this lunch with Stravinsky, you know, in Los Angeles in the, you know, early 70s.
Wow.
You know, and it was one of those moments where when it was done, you know, and we walked away, like, I remember my dad said to me, he said, you know, today won't mean anything to you. You'll forget it. But when you're older, this might have some kind of significance.
Wow.
You know, and I think that's kind of one of the interesting things about the West Coast is, you know, there's a lot of stereotypes and assumptions of, you know, what it is like and what culture is like here, but it has a very wide root system, you know, and incredible range of diversity. And I think that's one of the things that you find also in the music and art that's created, you know, and oftentimes the music and art is kind of intertwined. It's not separate silos, but it's, you know, it's intense crossovers. If you look at, you know, the early album covers of Black Flag, they're all drawn by Raymond Pettibone, the guitarist's brother.
Yeah.
You know, you see all this kind of circulation, you know, the kind of Mike Kelly's, you know, X, the, you know, Fear, Bukowski, street poetry, and it kind of merges and it creates this kind of, you know, really interesting, like, friction and energy.
Yeah, it's all interwoven. That's, I think, what's so interesting, especially in California. I love that Raymond and Black Flag example. But it's funny you mentioned Stravinsky, and we just talked about Norman, because I interviewed Norman, of course, as well. And he had a Stravinsky moment as well. It was like one of his significant moments as well. I'm like, Jesus, you guys have been very lucky. Do you remember? Do you have that visually still in front of you?
Yes, yeah, it's still kind of indelible in my mind. I still remember that afternoon. You know.
Shall we play some Stravinsky? Do you have a favorite piece that we should listen to?
I like Soldier's Tale, personally. You know, I like it more than pieces like Firebird or Rites of Spring. Soldier's Tale is really a piece where Stravinsky went back to his original interest in, you know, kind of peasant music and this kind of like very naive rural patterns of sound. And so you hear that in it. You hear him kind of an exorcism of this, you know, kind of folk music, like Eastern European folk music, but then kind of amplified into avant-garde.
Let's play it. I'm gonna hear it now.
Right?
Marching home. He goes marching home.
But yeah, the thing about California, and it has this stereotypical kind of image, it does. But if you dig a little deeper, I also had in my interview with Zubin Mehta. You know,
I
interviewed Zubin Mehta here in his home. And he lives here, right? And that was also insane, incredible, right? But we talked about that because of the movie industry that's been here. And with the World War II happening, all the Jewish composers, they all moved to California for all kinds of different reasons. But that kind of created that culture of like classical trained musicians and geniuses moving here. including Stravinsky.
I mean, it's a like very unusual culture, you know, and you know, most cultures go back to the landscape and the geography in which they're born. And you know, you look at major cities and they're built on ports or areas of distribution for agriculture or fishing or commerce. And you know, if you look at a city like Los Angeles, Los Angeles doesn't really have any of those reasons. There is nothing significant that's imported or exported. So you kind of see this desert swampland and you say, you know, why is this place here? And I think the answer to that is really, what do we distribute? We distribute images. You know, someone else, it might be wheat and soy. You know, we distribute trends, music, movies, images, media, content, all these things that are dematerial, but they kind of move at the speed of light. You know, you hear that song that's released yesterday in a taxi in Manila. You know, you hear it on iPod in London. You know, and I think there's something very kind of strange about that, that it's not the old kind of root system. It's more kind of this exchange, connect, move on at the speed of light mentality.
Yeah, I totally agree. And in one of those images, going to back to your work, Mirage in the desert, is that the origin of the idea, creating that image, basically, the Californian image, reflection?
It is in some way. So yeah, Mirage was a suburban ranch-style house made entirely of mirrors. It was built on a desert hillside, kind of overlooking the Coachella Valley. Mm-hmm. And in making this work, I was very interested in creating an artwork that would continuously change, which would constantly transform. And, you know, I think for me personally, I have a great frustration with art. I feel like art is incredibly conservative right now. I feel like it holds on to this almost academy-like idea that the artwork should be seen in a white room with track lighting in a controlled environment. You know, the museums and galleries function almost like real estate that's being programmed continuously. And I want to see art just explode out of that system. You know, I think art that you can discover, art that you can find, that will take you on a walkabout, things that can change continuously, that can embrace change. And with Mirage, it was really an attempt to make installation a sculpture that would merge with the landscape around it. So if you went there at night under full moon, the moon would reflect infinitely through the corridors of this reflecting house. The sunrise would change again. And, you know, when we were working on it, there was moments where, you know, I wasn't paying attention. I'd look over my shoulder to see it and I couldn't find it. It just disappeared into the desertscape. So I think a project like that for me is very important. And, you know, I try to continue to pursue the unknown, projects that are unfamiliar to me, where I feel like I'm stepping into a space that is new and I'm insecure about, but perhaps if we keep chipping away like a coal miner, we can make something that we could share.
I agree. And I love that. I love that about your approach to art as well. Talking about imagery and Mirage in this, for instance, do you think about how people, especially, I think Gen Z kind of discovered your work, I think, through Desert X for the first time with Mirage. It was such an Instagrammable moment. I think the most photographed piece of Desert X, right? We've seen it everywhere because everyone's mesmerized by it. Because at the end of the day, all you did is holding up a mirror again, what's happening in the surroundings. Yeah. I think that's and how that changed throughout the day. Do you, as an artist, also such a visual artist, do you think at this point with technology and how people perceive it, is it, I don't want to say, is it Instagrammable? Because that's not the purpose, but how people actually will consume it. Is it in the back of your mind when you come up with ideas, or is it completely abstract?
I mean, that's a interesting question. Like, do you think about the viewer and how it will be consumed, like when you make a work? And I don't really think about it in a literal way, but I'm very, very interested in empowering the viewer, creating works where the viewer is not simply looking at them in a detached manner and judging them, you know, do you like the red painting or the black painting? But instead, can the viewer step inside the artwork? Can they become it? Can they eat it? Can it become part of their life experience or even for an instant? And I think that those are the kind of walls that I'm interested in breaking. You know, and I think that that also is a territory where art can go, which is so fertile. It can become more a richer part of our lives. It can become more of a beacon, a lighthouse of experience and provocation, less passive and more proactive, perhaps.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I love that because it's an experience, engaging experience. I think you are like a spatial designer in a way, right? But going back to the sound,
yeah,
if you would have to define the sound of, let's say, the desert, underwater, another project of yours, and a white cube, what song would you give for each?
For each of those?
Yeah.
Oh, wow, that's pretty good. I mean, I think the white cube, I would give it Lamont Young. I would give it just a long, endless, infinite drone, you know? And I think that, you know, it's interesting. If you go back to New York in the mid-60s, you know, there is kind of a period where there actually was an avant-garde in New York.
Yeah, call it pressure cooker, you know? That's where the mixture, the cocktail.
And these, like, you know, these performances that Lamont Young would do, you know, it would include John Cale. It would include Terry Riley. It would be, you know, maybe a series of frequencies and drones that would go for 12 hours. You know, and people would come and go, they'd pass out on the floor, they'd wake up and the soundscape, the sound wave was still moving. And I think there's something so interesting when music kind of goes beyond the time code. It's not a 3-minute song, but it's a landscape you live in, you know. And going back to that idea of the city, like a city like New York, I was doing this kind of conversation project. I was talking to a lot of people about the starting point of their creativity. And I noticed that two separate people I spoke with had almost the exact same story as the biggest influence of their music. And that was James Murphy from LCD Sound System and Jack White, the guitarist. James said when he was a child in New Jersey, he would lie on the floor of his kitchen so he could have his ear close to the refrigerator. And it was the electric hum of electricity that was like the most beautiful and mesmerizing thing.
And my other thing from earlier even was lying in the kitchen. We had this refrigerator.
And when you're in Europe, they have a slightly different sound. If you're in Japan, they have a different sound. I realized like I'm very, very attached to that American hum.
And Jack White said to me, he said, I grew up in Detroit and it was impossible for the sound of factories not to influence your music.
I kind of see a similar sense of cycling and movement.
You can't live next to factories without being influenced by them. It's like living next to a train track or something. There's no way that doesn't influence you. It's just going to subconsciously get in your head whether you like it or not.
You hear those repetitious patterns and they just seep into you. And I think it's kind of interesting that, you know, to not be in denial, you know, creativity is not an autonomous island. It's part of the landscape around us. It's everything we absorb all the time. And it's interesting when you see like the patterns of our worlds, whether it's a digital or mechanical, kind of leach into the sounds and music that we create.
Wow. I agree. As a child, kind of already had that awareness. I mean, I'm not surprised. Genius, both of them. And also with that repetition.
Yeah, yeah.
That's kind of interesting.
And repetition, you know.
But
yeah,
three songs you have to give me.
Oh, yeah.
You can't escape the concept, honey.
Okay, so what have we got?
Okay, we got the city. We've got Underwater. What's the soundtrack of Underwater? And what's the soundtrack of the desert?
Going back to Velvet Underground, there is that great song, The Ocean.
There you go.
I mean, it's so beautiful. So kind of atmospheric.
Thank you.
You know, the desert, I always think of something with rhythm, with tempo, because I always think of the desert and driving. You know, it's kind of what you do here. You know, you're sick and tired of being sick and tired, so you bolt out to the desert alone. So many times.
Yeah, it's funny. It's part of the culture. It's part of the DNA. And I think that's also a way to let go. Exactly. In other cities, you have different kind of escapes. This is like you jump in your car, drive down the PCH and see what happens.
And isn't it interesting that, you know, when we think of these places, the ocean, the desert, the idea of escape, so often it's a horizontal landscape. Mm. You know, we're somehow psychologically escaping vertical space, combines vertical space, and we're looking for something where there is this kind of infinite horizon.
Yeah. I love the way you see the world. Do you create audio mood boards? Because sound plays such a big role in your work and life. But we're here in one of your studios, in your think tanks.
Yeah, yeah.
Do you listen to music on a daily basis? Do you have music in the background? Or does it influence a specific work when you think about? Or...
I mean, yes. You know, I find myself constantly searching for new sounds. Or oftentimes, you know, there's music always playing that, you know, I've found and it's looping or it's, you know, shuffling. But I think one of the interesting things to talk about is the connection in all the arts. And, you know, I found that there's been times where I'm working on an idea, a story maybe that I'm writing, a narrative, and I start hitting a wall. There was a time where I was stuck and I couldn't figure out where to take this idea, this artwork. And I started paying attention to the music in the background. And I could hear the structure of this composition. It was a piece by Terry Riley. And I said, wow, you know, that someone else has approached the same idea in a completely different medium, in a completely different era. Here's how they're workshopping it. It was, you know, I think that's for me when music becomes really magical, is not just when you're in the flow and the act of listening, but when you kind of zoom out and look at the macro view and you look at the structures of music, you look at the architecture of sound, you know, where's the door? Where's the room? What's the experience? Where does it lead you? You know, and that is just such a beautifully complex, hypnotic landscape. And I think to me, it really is, it's some of the best of humanity. It's some of the best of our potential of where we could go, where we could take things. And, you know, it's funny that that story I told you about, you know, listening, hearing this Terry Riley piece in the background, then led to like a lifetime friendship. You know, we talk every week. He's in Japan now. And you know, he's 85 and I'm 15.
Hashtag forever 21.
Is that a mandolier?
Yeah.
You know, but there's like this absolute synergy, and like, you know, and Terry's actually started drawing his music. You know,
wow.
He started like drawing pictograms of his music instead of writing notation.
Wow.
You know, and so it's just this, you know, kind of
interconnected,
flowing landscape.
Flow. I think flow is a key word. Also, we just talked about repetition and the movement along, which I think also ties into Station to Station, your beautiful film. Tell me the process of that, the story behind Station to Station, but also what's your favorite track of Station to Station by Bowie?
So Station to Station was a project that we did where I put together a train, and every train car was a nomadic studio. And this train...
Nomadic studio, I love that.
Yeah, I mean, I wish you were with us. And you know, the journey went 4,000 miles. It went from the Atlantic and snaked all through continental U.S. and out to the Pacific. And so the train was constantly generating new art and music. You know, there was a recording studio on it. You know, Stephen Shore would be shooting photographs. Thurston Moore would be doing, you know, noise guitar. You know, someone like Patti Smith would join and drop off and someone else would come on.
So cool.
And so it was really like this kind of, you know, exquisite corpse of creators. And we just wanted people to use it, not to do something they'd done before, but to say, this is a
blank canvas
for something totally new. And at every stop, we would annex the train station and we would turn it into a happening for that day, that night.
Love it. Kind of reminds me of those old footages I'm sure you've seen. I think either tour bus or trains with Janis Joplin and the Grateful Dead, right? Where they're just like on tour and just all together and just jamming. Whatever happens at that night happens.
Yeah.
Kind of reminds me of that energy.
Yeah. And on, like, beyond music, I wanted to really kind of involve other arts too. And I wanted to create this kind of radical friction. So, you know, you have
radical friction. I love
it. Yeah. So, I mean, you have, you know, you have a Carson Holler tent, you have Liz Glynn doing these
friend of the show
about the universe. You have you know, Olafur Eliasson made a drawing machine that kinetically drew from the motion of the train across the country. You know, you had kind of all these artworks that were, you know, separate or in tandem with the music that was being made, the dance and choreography. And really for me, it was a project that came out of necessity. I was just so fed up with the way culture is siloed and segregated, and art is over here and the museum system's over there, but music is way over there. Film is here, you know? And I felt like, you know, instead of kind of letting it get to me, I should probably be proactive and try to do something about it and try to do something that was artist direct. So, you know, really talk directly with all these creators and kind of give them space to breathe and make something new and meet new friends and collaborate. And also for the audience, because, you know, we didn't show this in museums. We showed it, you know, at train stations. It could be like a, you know, 1920s tumbleweed blowing through, guy sleeping on the bench, and then it turns into like a 1,000-person activation for a night.
Did you announce today we'll be in station so-and-so?
Yeah.
And Patty's going to perform? Did you announce it, or is it just like you just arrived and let's just start jamming?
We announced it a little in advance, but, you know, we never really knew what was going to happen.
Yeah. I love that. It's a very democratic way of approached, which I like about, because I'm sure it wasn't like a ticketed event at the train station.
Yeah.
Which is kind of also the concept for Avian Air, which I love, because it's like just sharing the access to these creative ideas and people, but in a very organic, authentic, and also everybody's welcome kind of approach, you know, like that's what makes it interesting.
Yeah,
like,
yes,
I want the homeless to come and join. I want the kids. I want the elderly couple. That's what makes it interesting because it's, again, not the segregation kind of element. Okay, this is music. These are the music fans, or this is an art exhibition. So you have the gallerists and so on, the collectors. No, it's like, let's face it, the best parties are house parties. Why? Because there's all kinds of people come together, right? I think that's the kind of that approach. But favorite track from station to station? Okay. You must have played that record though on the journey at some point. No?
Yeah, I think Bowie's like burned into my, you know, my neurology.
Have you ever met him? Worked with him?
Yeah, I met him once. Mm. Yeah, it was totally surprising. You know, I had a friend, Dean Kuiper, an amazing writer. Yeah. He was friends with David Iman.
Yeah.
And he calls me up. He says, you know, David's playing this unannounced show at this little place in LA. Like, you want to go? And, yes, of course. And I go there. It was like mid-90s or something. And we go backstage and, you know, he's happy to see my friend. And my friend Dean says, this is Doug. And Bowie says, he says, oh, yeah, your work, I've been following it. And he starts naming these pieces, like these different installations. Whoa. And like deconstructing them. And like, he would know the title, the year, the place it was shown. He had like thought about the story or the narratives of these different works. And I mean, I have to say, like, my, you know, I was kind of completely surprised.
What an honor. Like, how cool.
Wow.
I mean, he was an artist, period. I mean, no matter what medium, right? Yeah. And I know he wanted to be a painter. Oh, he was a painter, but wanted to be recognized by the establishment as well, which I think he never really got the way, because it was David Bowie, right? I knew from one gallerist friend, I'm not going to mention his name, but he came, I think, in the late 80s, early 90s to him with his work. What do you think, like, to be represented or to work with him? And I was like, yeah, of course, it's Bowie, but the work wasn't really, you know, for the gallery. Yeah. So how do you say no to Bowie? You know, it was very difficult, but I think it doesn't matter. It's just another creative output, you know? Yeah. There doesn't need to be a commerce element to it at that point, right? It's just, like, out there.
Yeah. I mean, that would be a favorite song that Cameron did on Diamond Dogs.
There you go.
Yeah. I'll make you a deal, like any other kind of date. You'll pretend we're walking home, cause your future's at stake. My set is amazing, it even smells like a street. There's a bar at the end where I could meet you and your friend. Someone scrawled on a wall, I smell the blood of their tree cutters. Wrote up scandals in other bars. Having so much fun with a wife and his people, spreading rumors and lies on stories they made up. Some make you sing and some make you scream. One makes you wish that you've never been seen. But there's a shop on the corner that's selling papier mache, making bulletproof faces, darling, that's the catch of playing a picture one. Boys, never hear this. Scream out of line, I want you, I need you. Anyone out there, anytime. Trick whistling number one, say dirty, I want you. When it's dirty, it's really
good and when it's bad, I got a message.
I mean, I think that whole album is like so underrated. There's so many kind of soundscapes and like experimentation and pieces of that album I've just put on loop for days, you know.
Because you can.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's timeless.
Yeah.
But going back to you, the three tracks that define you.
Okay, well, I just found another.
Yeah. We start there. Okay, you have two more.
Okay. Another song I really love is by a band called Bongwater, and the song is called Truth. Yeah, Bongwater is a kind of New York band in the 80s, Ann Magnuson and Kramer. You know, they're kind of, you know, on the fringes of art, and, you know, I think just making this incredibly smart music, you know, it just cut like a knife, the lyrics, the sound. They'd never made it or anything, but I love like kind of their aura of, you know, this kind of fast, irreverent, like no hierarchy, like cut it with a knife kind of, you know, sarcasm. Yeah, that song would be up there.
I love it.
Yeah.
Truth tellers lie to tell the truth tellers lie to tell the truth tellers lie to tell.
Done. We're here in beautiful Venice, California. You are from California.
Sun is breaking through.
Slightly, finally.
Green layer.
Yeah, we're getting there. Might get a chance for a tan today. What song defines California?
Well, I'll tell you actually what maybe defines California a little bit for me right now is we've actually been writing music, making music, and we've been making a song cycle for the last 4 years. And we're, you know, finishing it now. We're mixing it now.
Amazing.
It's a body of work. It kind of talks about being an individual now, kind of leaning towards a future in our landscape. And each of the songs is a phrase, a verse, or a single word that's kind of sung and repeated. And it is sung up to 50 vocalists. And it creates the song cycle that's about an hour or so. You know, we're mixing it right now, actually, in another room.
Oh, wow. When is the release? Oh,
so it'll be part of this film installation, a series of live performances that we'll be doing in about a year and a half. I could share some of that with you because I think it really does talk about, you know, this landscape now. And I've been really trying to channel a lot of impressions and ideas that I've had into music with this.
Please. Do you still go out? Do you go to concerts, listen to DJs? I mean, you work with a lot of musicians, obviously.
Yeah.
But do you actually go out actively or, let's say, getting ready for an evening? Do you listen to music when you get ready for a night out, for instance?
Yeah, I mean, I'd love to see live music. Like, we were just part of this Format Festival last weekend. It was a three-day festival, the first time in Arkansas.
Wow.
Yeah, and it was actually really exceptional. It kind of took over this forest and this field, and there was, you know, immersive installations, like live music, a lot of different genres from, you know, African to techno. And that was surprising. It was kind of beautiful because I was walking through that and it was kind of one of the first moments where I really felt like that COVID umbrella had shed.
Yeah.
You know,
I remember that moment.
Yeah, you're really kind of reconnecting with just random people, you know, adrift at nighttime, you know, the pulsing in the background.
Who knew we're going to miss being in a dark, sweaty room with strangers? Give me your dad.
Well, the word I've heard from Berlin is it's back.
Yeah, for sure. No shame there. Do you have a favorite techno track?
Yeah, probably.
We'll fade it in. Like, we don't have to mention it. We'll get back to me on that.
Well, we've been, you know, I'm seeing JBXX tonight, but
I'm going there with Caribou.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
I'll see you there.
Fantastic.
But Jamie's an interesting story because, you know, we knew each other just a little bit. And early on in COVID, you know, I get this phone call from him. You know, he can be like very quiet and shy. And he says, you know, hey, it's Jamie. And, you know, come on down. So he's, you know, in our guest house for a while.
Love it.
We're making music, we're road tripping, you know, and it just kind of, well, it was a COVID friendship that really kind of blossomed into collaborations. We've done some different happenings now.
Amazing.
Things and, you know, and it's fascinating when you kind of are with someone who's creating and you kind of have a window under the hood of like what their process is like, you know, where things come from, you know, are they precious or restless? Are they trying to put something together in a linear way, or are they piecing and pulling and ripping to, you know, diverse things, you know? So it's interesting because a lot of the tracks that, he was working on that are now coming to completion to be released.
Oh, wow.
Okay. You know, we've heard these like
forever
rough sketches and like remixes. And
I mean, he is an artist. I love the way he looks at the world and how he puts it together. So, but we're here with you. And what's this? What's your go-to falling in love or heartbreak?
Oh, I mean, I just thought of a piece of music now. If I had to, you know, put on that soundtrack for a period like that, like Witch from Zambia.
Oh.
You know, which is just a band that I love. And it was this period of time where I think there was briefly like a looser government in Zambia. Mm. And the president or prime minister at the time, like, you know, got in a taxi and he listened to the music that was playing on the radio. And he said to the taxi guy, he said, you know, where's this music? Where is it from? And the driver says, you know, this music's from South Africa. All the music's recorded in South Africa. That's where we get our stuff. And he said, no. I'm going to pass a law that, you know, something like 30% or 50% of all the music that we play here on the radio has to be from Zambia.
Whoa.
So he set up a recording studio, like one recording studio, the country. And, you know, you have all these, you know, people that are like young, that are restless, that are, you know, hearing the Stones on the radio and stuff like that, and can borrow a bass or a guitar or write some music with a Beatles-like melody, but it sounds completely African. Amalume.
Amalume Chifundo Ine Kumutima Kalani Chete Asieni Muasie Choncho.
The Western influences were there, or James Brown was a big player in that that sound of West Africa.
Dollar.
Exactly, but with the African approach to it, which makes it even way more interesting than the Western. Yeah. What's the sexiest song?
I mean, just pour some Giorgio Moroder on it.
We love some Moroder.
Yeah. I'll take anything. Midnight Express soundtrack. I mean,
done.
Yeah, American Gigolo, the PC produced, you know.
There's
something about like a lot of reverb that turns up the sexiness, you know, a lot of spatial.
Yes. And the synth and just the keys. And
I mean, I'm your psychologist.
You know everything about me. You listen to my music, you'll know everything about me. Make the playlist private.
Yeah, right.
Well, to wrap up our little chat, if your life would be a movie, what song would play in the end credits?
I think probably Can.
Cologne.
Yeah, going back to Cologne.
Yeah. I like how we wrap up our chat and start with Cologne.
We're going back to Cologne. But you know, there is a show I did in Frankfurt at this museum, the Sherman Kunst.
Yeah.
The director, who is amazing, says to me, you know, Doug, for your opening, you know, would you like a musician to play, like any musician, who would you like? And, you know, I think he thought that I was going to talk about some, you know, pop musician.
Jamie, come DJ.
Yeah, we get this like person who's known. And I said, actually, you know, I was looking at, you know, the still live German musicians I love. And, you know, could we get Jackie Liebisch, the drummer from
Cam?
He was still alive at the time. I think the museum's like it.
What?
You want who? Like the gardener? Cut to, it's like the opening night, and you know, Jackie shows up and he has a keyboard accompaniment. And David Bowie, going back to Bowie in the 70s, someone asked him who one of the most influential musicians was in the 70s.
Con,
Jackie Liebisch, the drummer of Can, because he creates these machine-like patterns, these polyrhythms, but they're so precise. And that's why Can could record the way they did. You know, Jackie would play for 3 hours, Can would play over it, then they'd cut it into a 3-minute song because the rhythm was always like precise. Anyways, you know, Jackie shows up, he's got this little drum stool. He's got like a bass and a snare and a cymbal, that's it. You know, and he sits upright with perfect posture, and like a robot, he starts playing these rhythms. And you know, the people that knew about it were completely
freaking out.
You know, half the people are just, you know, walking around.
What's going on?
What's this old man doing, like on a simple, you know, busker drum kit? So he's doing this, it's super amazing. And after 30 minutes or so, he just kind of stops, and he gets up and he kind of walks away. And I saw this happening. I thought, this is a travesty. We can't let this end. So I walked over to him and put my hands on his shoulders and just kind of put him back down on his drum seat, and his hands just kept continuing. And wow. It was just incredible, you know?
Like the Duracell bunny, right? Whoa, how long did he play for?
He played for another like 20 minutes or so.
Wow.
Yeah. I don't think he like noticed, you know?
Really? He was like in the zone.
In the zone.
Wow. Hey, this is the origin of electronic music there.
Yeah, so I put a canned mushroom head on my when I'm cremated, and they throw these ashes out into the Venice Beach canals.
I love it. Well, thank you very much for being on air with us.
Such a pleasure.
Yeah.
I love your irreverency, and it's been a fantastic chat.
Likewise. Yeah.
I love it.
Great.
Tuning in this week. If you want to listen to the full playlist, visit areweonair.com or our Spotify channel. You can also find us on Instagram and on YouTube at areweonair. And a big thank you to my wonderful team at Studio Noi. I'm Armand Nafei, and I'll speak to you soon.